Sarai Nieves' parents brought her to the U.S. when she was 7. She didn't have papers, but she grew up here. Then she had a son, a U.S. citizen, and she had to explain what it means to be undocumented in America.
How can you tell a 4-year-old? If we don't do this, if we don't go through this, we might be taken apart.
This is a State of Opportunity documentary, Out from the Shadows, from Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. This hour, behind the headlines, the talking points, and the campaign rhetoric, what is life really like for a family living without papers in this heated moment in America?
And if we don't move fast, things can get worse. So wipe the tears off and get back up and start thinking of what are the next steps we should do.
This is State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer.
There was this person that they were looking for. They came in a regular car, a normal car.
Sarai Nieves was at her home outside with her family, her parents, her two brothers, and her 4-year-old son.
When they turned their backs to us, that's when we saw the words ICE.
ICE. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. ICE is who shows up to arrest and deport immigrants living in the U.S. without approval. And on that day, 4 years ago, Sarai Nieves was one of those immigrants without approval. And right there in front of her were 4 people who could take her away from her son forever, or take her parents away from her.
At that moment, it was like if they had thrown a bucket of ice on your back. It was like you froze. You didn't know if to run, if to just stay still. It was right in front of us. That all of this was happening, and we didn't know if they were going to come towards us, if they were going to ask us questions. But we started to take a few steps back towards the door, and then we noticed that they went to the neighbor's house and they started to surround the house. And so we, as quickly as we could, without making a lot of noticeable movements, we went inside, turned off the lights, and just stood in the darkness.
Just stood there. Nieves says it was one of the scariest moments of her life. Her son was 4 years old at the time.
My child, he's a U.S. citizen. And even though that they have papers, they have to go through that. And I don't think that's fair. My son, the first time that happened, I didn't know how to explain it to him what was going on. All I said was, we just have to stay quiet. We have to turn off the lights, and I'm like, just make sure that there's no noise. He was crying because he didn't understand what was going on. How can you tell a 4-year-old? If we don't do this, if we don't go through this, we might be taken apart. You might not see me, I might not see you. I just can't.
Sarai Nieves has been living in fear most her life. The fear that someone would find out her secret. She didn't spend much time outside as a kid. She never told anyone her family came to the United States without their papers. She was too afraid to speak up. Millions of people live with this fear in America. 11 million, if the experts are correct. That's about 1 out of every 30 people in the entire country. This hour, we're going to hear what it's like to be one of those people, right now, at this moment in America, when so much is up in the air for undocumented immigrants, when so much is at stake. This is Out from the Shadows.
Good afternoon, everybody. This morning, Secretary Napolitano announced new actions my administration will take to mend our nation's immigration policy.
June 15, 2012, in the Rose Garden at the White House, President Obama spoke on a new policy that would change Saray Nieves' life. It was a policy that the president had previously said he couldn't do. He, a former constitutional law professor, said as president he didn't have the power to do the very thing he was now announcing he would do. And what he would do was to allow a certain group of undocumented immigrants, young people brought here as children, to come forward and get a guarantee they wouldn't be deported for a few years. It wasn't forgiveness or amnesty. It was a deferral. The backlash against this policy started even before the president could get the words out of his mouth.
It is the right thing to do. Excuse me, sir. It's not time for questions, sir. Not while I'm speaking.
500 miles away, in Sturgis, Michigan, Saray Nieves heard about this new program that could bring her out of the shadows, that promised she wouldn't have to hide anymore from immigration police, that she wouldn't have to explain to her son what might happen if she was arrested. She heard about it, and she was nervous.
I was scared. I did not file right away. I did not know if this was something real, something... I feel like I was dreaming at the time, but I was also scared. Because, like, we've been always in the shadow. We've been always trying to stay hidden.
The promise of this new program, called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, was that Saray wouldn't have to hide anymore. But that was also the downside. She had to turn over her information, submit to a background check, and submit biometric data to the very government she'd been hiding from her whole life. The Obama administration said it would protect immigrants like Saray from deportation. But this wasn't law. The administration could change its mind. A new president could come in and deport everyone on the DACA rolls. So Saray waited. Her brother signed up first.
And after I saw that it was okay, it was safe, there was nothing that would put me in danger in filing for a work permit and for a deferred action, I went ahead and applied in October, and I received my documents in February.
This, it turned out, was a huge change for Saray and more than 700,000 other young immigrants who've signed up so far. She got her work permit. She became less worried about everything, about being out in public, about driving, and about speaking out in public at political rallies to tell the truth about her family's situation. She had a deferral, but her parents were still at risk. Then in 2014 came another announcement from the president.
That night, I remember it very well. It was snowing.
It was November. Saray went to Kalamazoo for an event to watch the president's speech.
And so I got there, and there was all these other families waiting, and there was music. There was so much excitement, and at the same time, you can feel like there was tension of what's going to be announced. And then that moment came when we turned on the screen projector.
My fellow Americans.
And President Obama was talking.
Tonight I'd like to talk with you about immigration.
And then he announced the DAPA.
If you've been in America for more than 5 years, if you have children who are American citizens or legal residents, if you register, pass a criminal background check, and you're willing to pay your fair share of taxes, you'll be able to apply to stay in this country temporarily without fear of deportation. You can come out of the shadows and get right with the law.
He was talking about people like Saray's parents. They fit the requirements. This new policy would bring the whole family out from the shadows, take away the fear of deportation they'd been living with for almost 2 decades in the U.S.
It was tears, it was joy, it was excitement. And I called my parents and I told them.
Immediately, the family started preparing, gathering papers, getting documents in order to apply. And then
We awake this morning to a big court decision in Texas.
A federal judge is challenging President Obama's executive action.
In a strongly worded opinion, Judge Andrew Hanen of the Southern District of Texas wrote that the president's actions are, quote, a massive change in immigration practice.
This ruling comes a day before the first phase of the president's plan was to go into effect.
It was as if they, it's kind of like when they give you a gift and then they take it back. And until this point, we're still waiting.
We recorded this conversation in early June. At that point, the order blocking the president's immigration plan was still in effect. Somewhere between 4 and 5 million people, like Sadai's parents, were waiting. The Supreme Court decision was expected soon. It could come any week. Sadai's family and millions of others just needed 5 people, 5 votes on the Supreme Court, a majority opinion.
But I think there's still hope, and I don't want to give up on that hope.
We didn't know when the decision would come. It turned out it was on a Thursday, June 23rd. I was in Grand Rapids when the news hit.
I'm calling Sarai Nieves. Hi, Sarai. This is Dustin Dwyer from Michigan Radio. How's it going? Yeah, so you're following the news. Yeah, that's what I saw. I still haven't seen, I don't know if they issue an opinion or if they say anything about it, but a tie is not good, right?
A tie meant the program for Sarai's parents would stay frozen. She and the more than 700,000 young immigrants signed up for DACA still have their deferral. But for the much larger group of parents, including Sarai's parents, there would be no work permit, no driver's license, no deferral from deportation. There would just be the same old fear. ...11 million people in America live with this problem, are still living with this problem. How did things ever even get to this point?
To safeguard America first, to stabilize America first, to prosper America first, to think of America
that
first.
That is the voice of Warren G. Harding from 1920. We'll hear what he has to do with all of this in just a few minutes. This is Out from the Shadows, a State of Opportunity documentary on Michigan Radio.
God pity him for whom no minstrel raptures dwell.
This is State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. This hour, Out from the Shadows.
My name is Rosario Nieves.
Rosario Nieves has welcomed me into her home to tell her story. We sit at the dining room table. Her daughter Sarai is there to help interpret. It was very difficult, she says. What she remembers is fear.
Es un miedo que a veces no quiero recordar porque es muy triste.
She says it's a fear that it's so scary that she doesn't want to remember it. And as she told, and as she was saying the story, she said she could feel that fear again.
Heat, hunger, walking morning and night, Rosario Nieves says. A painful journey. A journey filled with fear. I'm sitting there hearing this story at a nice dining room table in a house the Nieves family has remodeled. Everyone pitched in. New tile, new walls, fresh paint, new appliances in the kitchen. It's a dream home. And I'm thinking about the sacrifices Rosario and her husband made to get their family to this place. I'm thinking about it as a parent. I'm a parent. And what we always say is, we'd do anything for our kids. Anything. Sarai's parents meant it. But Sarai says they never talk about this story, in part because it's painful, but also because it could get them into trouble. This sacrifice, this huge sacrifice they made for their kids, for their family, it did not have the blessing of the state. It was, according to federal authorities, illegal. And so I'm also thinking, as we talk about it, why it was illegal, how it came to be illegal. And that story starts long, long before Rosario Nieves ever thought of taking her kids on a journey through the desert. For more than half the history of the United States, there was no limit on immigration. There was barely even inspection of the people coming through. Ellis Island didn't open until 1892, and when ships arrived in New York from Europe, first and second class passengers were waved right on through. Only third class even had to stop at Ellis Island. The southern border of the U.S. was little more than a line on a map. Most of the western United States actually was Mexico until 1848, and even after that, there was no formal border enforcement. Until,
my countrymen,
World War I changed things. European immigration to the United States reached its peak during the war years, and after the war was done, U.S. leaders feared being overrun by refugees from Europe's devastated cities. In 1920, Warren G. Harding argued against joining the League of Nations and instead preached America first.
To safeguard America first, to stabilize America first, to prosper America first.
The next year, in 1921, Congress, for the first time, put a limit on how many immigrants would be allowed into the United States. It set up a quota system for each foreign country. In 1924, Congress created the Border Patrol. And let's be clear, the laws on immigration back then were explicitly racist. America's first immigration law, the Naturalization Act of 1790, said right in the text that only free white people could apply for citizenship. That language didn't even disappear from federal immigration law until 1952. And then there were the quotas on how many immigrants could enter from each foreign nation. Those quotas implicitly excluded certain racial and ethnic groups. But throughout this time, Congress didn't place any numerical limit on immigration from Latin America. There was already a long history of people coming across the southern border to work temporarily in the United States and then return home. That didn't mean immigrants were exactly welcome.
Our greatest primary task is to put people to work.
That's Franklin Roosevelt in his first inauguration, 1933. During the Depression, many cities and states across America encouraged immigrants, particularly Mexican immigrants, to repatriate. It was deportation through coercion, sometimes violence, though it wasn't official federal policy. It's estimated 1 million people returned to Mexico during that time. Many of them were actually U.S. citizens. But attitudes in the U.S. about immigrants crossing the southern border would continue to change like the tides all through the 20th century.
Farming is America's biggest industry.
After World War II broke out in the 1940s, the U.S. faced another labor shortage. And Roosevelt's administration reached a deal with Mexico to send workers north to work again on U.S. farms to ensure the food supply for a nation at war. It was called the Bracero Program.
Yes, with the domestic supply of farm labor being inadequate, braceros are a must. But some people say to the farmer,
well, make the pay high enough and you'll pull in all the domestic labor you need.
The fact is that farm wages have gone up steadily for many years. But we still don't have enough seasonal domestic labor willing to do this kind of work.
The Bracero program lasted for decades, long after the war ended. This video by the Council of California Growers was produced sometime around 1959. Even as that was happening, though, there would be moments in which the U.S. government would turn against immigrants. Like in 1954, when the federal government initiated a deportation program and named it with a word that today is a racial slur. It was called officially Operation Wetback. The next big tide change in U.S. immigration policy came in 1965.
The days of unlimited immigration are past. But those who do come will come because of what they are and not because of the land from which they sprung.
President Johnson stood at Liberty Island in front of the Statue of Liberty to sign the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act. This new law did away with the old quota system so that immigrants could be admitted from any nation, but they would now be admitted based on family connections already in the United States or based on their work skills. A wave of new immigrants arrived after the signing of this bill, and while the law did not restrict how many people could come from each nation, it said that no nation could account for more than 7% of all immigrants granted green cards in a given year. And this created a backlog of applications from certain countries, like China, the Philippines, and Mexico. But because businesses kept hiring workers, because the United States couldn't actually check every mile of its border, every seat on every airplane or bus, millions of people still came to the United States to work without getting official approval. The number of people who came illegally kept adding up until...
I'm very pleased that you could all be here today.
In 1986, President Reagan signed yet another law meant to reform immigration in the U.S.
Our objective is only to establish a reasonable, fair, orderly, and secure system of immigration into this country and not to discriminate in any way against particular nations or people.
As he signed this law, President Reagan created a new federal policy toward illegal immigration, the policy of amnesty. Nearly 3 million undocumented immigrants came forward to sign up. The law forgave them, and it allowed them a way to become citizens here. The law also called for more enforcement and sanctions against businesses that gave jobs to undocumented immigrants, and it called for more enforcement at the border. Those two parts of the law faded over time. So more immigrants came, papers or not. The number of undocumented immigrants in the U.S. would triple over the next 20 years. And the Nieves family arrived right in the middle of that, around 1998.
My brother, he had a small shoe business where we would make shoes.
Sarai Nieves translates again as her father tells the story of why he decided to come to the United States.
So it all started when Mexico kind of went into a recession with NAFTA, where it was cheaper for the stores or locals to buy out of the country instead of paying their own people. So he's like, all of that started affecting us because we were in a small town.
Businesses dried up. He worried whether his family would make it. But he had an uncle in the United States, and his brother went to check it out. And so then he went too. And after that, his wife, Rosario Nieves, followed with the kids.
When you made the decision to come to the United States, did you know that there was some process with papers that you had to go through? And what did you know about that then?
Mama, cuando...
Sarai translates my question for her mom.
Sí sabía que necesitábamos un pasaporte.
I did know that there was a passport that was needed, but at that time, I looked at the need of my children because there wasn't jobs, there wasn't much that we could do from the town that we were from.
Then, after a pause, Sarai adds this.
I know a lot of you are always thinking, well, why can't they wait? Why can't they wait in line? Or how hard is it to wait? And I ask you this question. If you see your child in hunger, how much are you going to wait?
Lots of people in the United States say they're fine with immigrants, as long as immigrants arrive, quote, the right way. Lots of us don't actually know what the right way is for someone from Mexico. Right now, there's a waiting list for anyone from Mexico who wants to get a green card in the United States. That waiting list, depending on your exact circumstances, can be close to 2 decades long. The Nieves family was hurting in 1998. They weren't sure they'd have the money to buy food for their kids. And in the years they would have had to wait for their visa, the drug trade got worse in Mexico. In the state where they lived, a drug cartel, the Templarios, now controls many areas and kills people seemingly at random. So yeah, the Nieves family, they didn't wait around to watch that happen. They came north and they broke the law. They broke the law to save their children. And now, they hide. Because even after 18 years of following every other law in the United States, it was that first unlawful act that still defines them in this country. They're forced to hide.
Yo quiero que estas personas que puedan escuchar estas palabras.
What I want, Rosario Nieves says, is if anyone can hear these words, help us. Help us and the other families that are in this situation. You're listening to Out from the Shadows on State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. I'm standing outside St. Francis Xavier Catholic Church in Grand Rapids on a sunny Sunday. Today is Father's Day, and the organizers from Michigan United have set up a booth to remember the fathers who aren't here today, the fathers who have been deported. I was told that there are dozens of families in this parish that have had a separation like this, where the father has been sent to some other country, has been deported to another country. The families remain here. Often, the children are U.S. citizens. They were born here. And a lot of families where that's the case, the mother also doesn't have papers and is at risk for deportation. And so they just kind of lay low. And so the rest of us don't really even know that this is happening in our communities. The children are being raised without their fathers. The children have been separated by a border from their families.
It was 4 years ago, and it seems like if it was just yesterday.
Isabel Pablo lives in Grand Rapids. She was an adult when her parents were deported. She says they were arrested on a Sunday.
It was just a random day. We got out of a circle of prayers from church, and they went to pray to with this lady that was in need of spiritual help. So they went to her house. And that day, they came knocking on her door looking for someone else that were not my parents. But my parents, since they did not know how to communicate very well in English, and this fear overcame their at that moment, they just didn't do nothing. And they got arrested.
Isabel found out later that night. And because she was undocumented at that time, she couldn't visit them in jail. So she didn't get to see them again before they were deported.
They didn't have any criminal history. They were just people that were serving to the community, serving to the church community, hard workers. They were great grandparents. They were always there for us. They were not criminals. They were not doing anything wrong. They were just helping some lady with spiritual help.
She says it's been 4 years since she's seen her parents, gotten to hug them, or hold their hand in prayer. She now has deferred action from deportation, but it's really difficult for someone in her situation to travel outside the United States. And in Grand Rapids, she has a husband, a job, she has children who are American citizens. So they have no plans to move. But she misses her parents, though.
It really hurts me. It really hurts me because we grew up together. We celebrated Christmas together. We had dinner together. We watched our favorite shows together. Went to the park, went to the beach during summer. And now those moments, they can't come back again. They can't. So they were torn apart from me. And I really, really miss them a ton. I really, really do. And I wish that I could be granted one day the wish to go see them.
She doesn't know right now if that day will ever come. I reached out to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Most people just call it ICE. That's the agency that carries out deportation orders in the United States. It has an office in Detroit. A spokesperson there declined a recorded interview with Michigan Radio. We got an emailed statement instead. The full statement reads, ICE is committed to focusing on smart, effective immigration enforcement and makes custody determinations on a case-by-case basis, prioritizing serious criminal offenders and other individuals who pose a risk to national security or public safety. ICE's role in the immigration enforcement system is focused on two primary missions. One, the identification and apprehension of criminal aliens and other removable individuals located in the United States, and two, the detention and removal of those individuals apprehended in the interior of the U.S., as well as those apprehended by CBP officers and agents patrolling our nation's borders. The immigration laws in the United States are a matter of federal policy, and they're enforced by federal agencies. But Sarai Nieves and her family live in a small town in a rural area. It's a conservative place that's seen an influx of immigrants in the past 20 years. So locally, how have people reacted to these immigrants?
It's been a fact for many years that they've been a good and productive fabric of our community here in Sturgis.
The little town of Sturgis, Michigan, out from the shadows, from State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. This is State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. This hour, out from the shadows, living undocumented in Michigan. After 18 years living in the United States without papers, Sarai Nieves had allowed herself to hope. She signed up for a program that protects her from deportation, at least for a few years. It's called DACA. Then another program came along from the Obama administration that could do the same for her parents, DAPA. It would allow her whole family to have work permits, driver's licenses, and live without the constant fear of being pulled over, asked for documentation, and deported. They'd been living 18 years with that fear. 18 years of working hard, buying a house, spending money in their community, giving back, earning a good, clean living without breaking any laws. Except for the one law that defines this whole family's life in this country. The one law that says they should never have come here to begin with, no matter how much they've contributed since they arrived. That one law. Sarai Nieves had allowed herself to believe that law might someday relinquish its power over her family, and they could live in peace, without fear. DAPA could have done that. But then a judge in Texas froze the program. And Sarai waited, along with millions of other families, to find out if the Supreme Court would allow DAPA to remain frozen. She had hope, until the day the ruling came down. Sarai says she was watching the TV alone. Her mom was in another room, resting.
And she came out and she saw that I was crying. And she's like, what's wrong? What's going on? And so I told her they didn't allow it. They didn't unfreeze it. And so then we both started crying.
Around that time, she got a phone call from me. We talked for just a bit, but she wasn't up for an interview that day.
That day, it was kind of like a gray day for me. It was very sad, devastated kind of feeling. I didn't know where to go from there. I thought we were kind of like lost. And I didn't want to talk at that moment. But like, as the day went on and I thought about, this is not going to get us anywhere. And if we don't move fast, things can get worse. So wipe the tears off and get back up and start thinking of what are the next steps we should do.
So she invited me to meet up on a Sunday at her church. She says one thing she wanted to do is to take me on a tour of her community, to show me and to prove what immigrants have contributed to her town. She lives in Sturgis, Michigan. It's a little town of about 11,000 people, south of Kalamazoo, right on the border with Indiana. It's surrounded by fields of corn, the strip of low brick buildings downtown, and an old movie theater that's still kicking. And Sturgis, little rural Sturgis, has a thriving, growing Hispanic community. According to the census, the town is now almost a quarter Hispanic. Some people told me they thought the real number is actually higher. We leave the church, and the first place we go is Sarai's old elementary school.
So this is Congress School.
Rain starts falling on the window shield of Nieves' Ford Explorer. Through the drops, I see the two-story red brick building, the playground. This is where Sarai came when she was 7 years old, first arriving in the United States. She didn't speak any English. She says on her first day, she couldn't understand a word in class. She wanted to leave. But she made it through, and she became one of the best students.
I remember that when third grade was here, I love math to this day. And multiplication was one of the things we were memorizing. And then when I got to fourth grade, I was the one that, like, the top person where we competed with each other and see who knew their times tables the fastest.
She was a good student all the way through high school. She thought she'd go to college. She even visited a campus in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And then she found out the school required a Social Security number, and she didn't have one. She was crushed. And at that time, in 2010, she felt like she had no other options. She felt like all her hard work until that point was for nothing. Next, in Sarai's tour of Sturgis, she takes me to a local business named El Taco Loco. It's owned by this guy.
Pues mi nombre es Daniel López. Somos originarios de Michoacán.
Sarai helps interpret.
His name is Daniel López, and along with his wife, in these past 3 years, they've been able to open two locations now, and they're original from Michoacán, and they said that thanks to God, they're at where they are.
López says he was born in the United States, but he was raised in the Mexican state of Michoacán. He came to Sturgis for a job at a mushroom farm. Then he worked in construction for a while. Then, with the help of his family, he opened his first business. And at noon on a Sunday, in the middle of a rainstorm, his place is plenty busy. Families are there. One person tells me his family drives up from Indiana. This is the best Mexican food around. Now, I ask López if he's noticed any change in his community in the past year, while the rhetoric about immigration has heated up everywhere else. I ask him as a business owner, a job creator, and someone from an immigrant background, what he thinks of a certain presidential candidate, last name Trump.
Pues mira.
Look, he starts off.
I respect his point of thinking or way of thinking, but we know that it's not true. We know that what he's saying is not true, and I'd rather invite him over to have some tacos.
This isn't exactly what I expected, honestly. I guess I expected more tension, more animosity. Next in our tour, Sarai takes me to a small yellow building along the main road in Sturgis, Carniceria Michoacán. Inside, we're greeted by the smell of slow-cooked meats at the taco counter. A TV overhead plays a soccer game, and this man stands behind the counter.
Bueno, mi nombre es Gustavo García.
So his name is Gustavo García, and they've opened up their business since 2006. And he says thanks to the community, they've been able to keep going, and they hope to keep moving on.
García was born in Mexico, and he arrived in Sturgis in 1992, one of the earliest Mexican immigrants to this town.
Bueno, el motivo de moverme yo a Sturgis fue el trabajo.
He said he used to live in Chicago, and they moved from Chicago to Sturgis. And the reason they moved was because over there life was faster, more hard, it was harder. And when they moved to Sturgis, he really liked how it felt, more freedom, more relaxed.
He told me at first he felt a little out of place. People would question him when he spoke Spanish in public. But to him, he says it wasn't exactly racism. And as more Hispanics arrived to the town, things got better. His business is doing well and growing. So I kept wondering, where was the conflict? Everywhere else, I hear such heated conversations. Talk of immigrants taking over, stealing jobs on the one hand. Talk of discrimination and anger on the other hand. So I spent some time on my own asking other people from Sturgis about this. And the first person I talked to is actually the person who introduced me to Sarai Nieves in the first place. Her name is Allison Kohlberg. She's with an activist group called Michigan United, and she grew up in Sturgis.
It was a good place to grow up, you know. It was very safe and very homey.
And Kohlberg says she remembers growing up and realizing more and more immigrants, particularly Mexican immigrants, showing up in the schools and around town. And once in a while, there'd be a conflict here or there. She says you could hear some people grumble about illegal aliens in the town.
But at the same time, Sturgis was starting to really struggle economically, and trying to figure out, like, how are we going to keep this town alive? And then at the same time, you had this wave of new people, new families who were, like, starting small businesses and filling up the classrooms at school and shopping at the stores. And so I think maybe part of why there wasn't such a backlash was that folks were buying houses, folks were renting apartments, folks were spending their money there, folks were working, and, like, it was good for the town.
It's been a fact for many years that they've been a good and productive fabric of our community here in Sturgis.
Aaron Miller also grew up in Sturgis. Now he represents this district in the Michigan House of Representatives. He's a Republican, and this is certainly Republican territory. But Miller tells me he never heard many people around here make a big deal about immigrants arriving without papers. Not when he was growing up, and not now when he takes calls from constituents.
It hasn't been an issue. You'll hear the occasional political argument, the frustration about illegal immigrants and taking our jobs. But the truth is, here in Sturgis, we're at rock-bottom unemployment. And if you ask a factory owner here in Sturgis, they will say, we need 50 people to show up for work yesterday. So as far as taking our jobs, it's simply not true. So I don't think you get a lot of frustration about the fact that there could be a number of illegal immigrants.
I would definitely say that we don't have a conflict when it comes to our immigrant population at all.
Jeff Smith is director of Sturgis's Department of Public Safety.
Like I said, most of the immigrants that we have been here for quite some time, have businesses, homes, jobs, and that type of thing. So we really don't get the phone calls or anything like that with people concerned with somebody being undocumented or things like that.
Smith says when his police officers make a traffic stop, they do always check for driver's licenses. And from time to time, still, it turns out that the driver doesn't have one. And those people may be referred to federal immigration officers. But in just the day-to-day law enforcement of Sturgis, he says illegal immigration, it's not a topic that comes up a lot. Not in this town. You're listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. This hour, Out from the Shadows, the story of families living undocumented in Michigan, one family in particular. In Sturgis, Michigan, lots of undocumented immigrants I spoke to said they feel welcome. But that doesn't mean the rest of America has welcomed them. And it doesn't mean the laws at the federal level are welcoming. After a quick tour of her town, Sarai Nieves takes me back to her church, Holy Angels. The rain's cleared, the sun's back out, it's hot, and it's muggy in the parking lot, where a number of Sarai's family members have just arrived. She tries to rope them into an interview.
No, you got to do this too.
One brave young man steps up.
Are you guys cousins?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you just introduce yourself, say your name and where you live?
My name is Jonathan Nieves, and I live down the street.
Jonathan is in high school. He plays on the soccer team. He's fit, with short hair. He's dressed up nice for church. He tells me he was born in Mexico, but his parents brought him here to Sturgis when he was two. So this is the only home he remembers. And he strikes me as just a typical all-American teenager. He is really not into the politics of this immigration thing. But we're standing there on the Sunday after a major Supreme Court decision affecting millions of immigrant families, including his own. The court, in a tie vote with no further explanation, effectively blocked a new program that would protect millions of immigrants from deportation.
Do you follow the news about all that stuff, or you don't really follow?
Kind of.
What did you find out on Thursday what the Supreme Court was? Were you following that?
Oh, no. I was too busy.
So was it a big deal to you when you heard?
I haven't heard it yet.
I look over at Sarai, his cousin. I'm not sure which one of us should tell him. Sarai does it.
You want to tell
him? They, you know how we were waiting to see if the Supreme Court would allow our parents to have DAPA? Well, they said that right now it's a tie, so it's not moving forward. If it would have been unfrozen, our parents could have applied for a work permit. Did you know?
No. Is it a big deal? Do you think, was that something you had been thinking about?
Well, I think about it now and it's kind of sad because most parents need that to work and stuff and to be able to drive most of all.
Without a work permit, without a driver's license, they could be deported at any time. The Obama administration, the Department of Homeland Security, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, all of them say they're not after people like Sarai and Jonathan's parents. They say they target people with criminal records. But people here have heard stories. People all over will tell you stories. Agents came looking for one person, ended up taking someone else. So the fear is real. And whatever's going to happen in Washington, D.C., however long it takes for the people in charge to actually step up and do something, it has a real immediate effect on people's lives. It has an effect right here in Little Sturgis, Michigan. We're still standing in the parking lot in the heat before church starts, when Sarai spots some more family, and she introduces me to her uncle, Carlos Lopez. I ask him how the Supreme Court decision affects him.
So, with
this decision, it was heartbreaking, it was devastating, because it kind of took away our hopes, and it turned off that light of hope that we had, and I hope that we get a president or a candidate that has a heart.
We have to persevere, he adds. He says he's been in Sturgis about 16 or 17 years. He says he likes it here. He likes the people here. When I ask if he plans to stay, Lopez says, it's in God's hands. And then he turns and he goes inside with his family to church. Come, Holy Spirit, the people are singing. I walk in a few rows up, stand at the edge of the pew holding my microphone. Next to me, a man sways to the beat, cradling his young son, kissing his head. The church is full, parents, children, families. In here, people aren't identified by their papers. In here, it's the families that matter, their faith, not the federal government and its laws. In here, no one is afraid, for now, of being separated. In here, families are together. The man kisses his son's head, like I kiss my son's head. And the people sing. Amen. Zoe Clark is executive producer of State of Opportunity. Vincent Duffy is our news director. Sarah Hewlett edited this documentary. The State of Opportunity team is Jennifer Guerra, Paulette Parker, April Van Buren, and me. Mercedes Mejia contributed with translation for this documentary. To hear this again and find out more about the music you heard, go to michiganradio.org and click on State of Opportunity. You can also download the audio from the State of Opportunity podcast feed, which is available on iTunes. I'm Dustin Dwyer.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.